Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armodian. In this hour, are targeted assassinations of state representatives legal? Does a target's past support for terrorism or military aggression matter in this determination? What might be legitimate targets of air campaigns or other uses of military power? Does the legality of the use of military and the types of actions matter in the 21st century? Our contributing host, Doug Becker, raises these questions.
To start 2020, the United States used a drone to kill Iranian General Qassem Soleimani. The Iranians retaliated with missile strikes against U.S. military assets in Iraq. Under what legal authority did the U.S. kill the Iranian leader? Are targeted assassinations legal under international law? We discuss the laws of war and the current tensions between the United States and Iran. Today's panel is Mark Drumbel, professor at Washington and Lee University School of Law and the director of the Transnational Law Institute. He has many publications, including Reimagining Child Soldiers in International Law and Policy. And Hannah Gary, clinical professor of law at the University of Southern California. She is director of the International Human Rights Clinic. She has written Witness Proofing in International Criminal Law Procedure, the Interface of Civil Law and Common Law Legal Systems. And Hamoud Sahi, Associate Dean of International Education at California State University at Dominguez Hills. He is a specialist in Middle East politics and a regular commentator for Arab media. So to start, Mark Drumbel, this choice of a targeted assassination against the Iranian leader, what is the status of such a decision in international law? Is it legal?
Well, the idea of violence being deployed in a military context is a very fraught area of international law, but at its very, very core, there has to be a threat that has to be seen as imminent in nature before force can be deployed. And that would satisfy a rudimentary understanding of what self-defense is. One of the major problems with the laws of war is they tend to have been developed in a time and place when the use of military force involved armies crossing borders and engaging in attacks in a very Clausewitzian or a very classical sense. Technology has created a context in which the push of a button can effectively eliminate a perceived target. And one of the major concerns that arises is to what extent does proof have to be assembled of an imminent threat? To what extent can one single individual actually threaten the viability of a nation state? And when it comes to technology, the concentration of power within one individual to push a button or command a button to be pushed really affects, certainly the United States at the domestic level, checks and balances. So I think the answer to your question is the law is extremely unsettled when it comes to these sorts of targeted assassinations and targeted killings. That said, if you pull into the individual context of an individual target the backdrop of the laws of war, then unless an imminent threat can be shown, then the use of force, in this instance a targeted killing, would not be justified.
Hannah Gary, your response?
So, yes, I would agree with Mark that the law here is unsettled. And the question does nevertheless turn very much with regard to the issue of imminence, and there the devil is in the details, and we don't know enough on the facts with regard to intelligence, both on the U.S. side but also on the Iranian side. But I would like to step back a bit and note that not only is the law a bit unsettled, but it's also really, we need to clarify here what areas of international law are at issue. And with Mark's reference to the imminence test, we're looking at the laws or rules on use of force by states under the UN Charter, also known as the Jus Ad Bellum. But we're also potentially looking at, as was referenced, violation on rules on the conduct of armed conflict or international humanitarian law, the rules in armed conflict or the jus in bello. But also at issue here could be, you know, violations of international human rights law, particularly the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, as well as depending on the how extreme the violations of the laws on use of force or the rules of international humanitarian law, how extreme those violations might be. We could be looking at international criminal law or violations that rise to the level of international crimes. And here I'm thinking of potentially the issue of aggression under international criminal law. So it's not only a question, I think, of unsettled, but also of what is the applicable law here. And I think that Mark was correct in going straight to the law or rules on use of force. And it's clear under the UN Charter that there is a requirement by states under the UN system, and that includes the United States and Iran, to first and foremost resolve any disputes peacefully under Article 2.3 of the UN Charter, and that states are prohibited under Article 2.4 from threats or use of force unilaterally to resolve their disputes. And the one exception to that prohibition is that right of use of force in self-defense. And so that's what this really turns on here, is whether under Article 51, under the facts of the situation that the United States targeted killing here of Soleimani was in fact exercise of an inherent right of individual or collective self-defense. Now, the UN Charter does require that there actually be an armed attack on a state in order to exercise that inherent right. And we don't have evidence here that there was an armed attack by Iran directly in any event against the United States that would justify this killing in response. Nevertheless, the argument could be made that under customary international law, the United States was acting in anticipatory self-defense. But where a state can have the right to strike first in self-defense without an armed attack, where there is the threat of an imminent attack. Now, that imminent attack needs to be instant, overwhelming, leaving no choice of means and no moment of deliberation. And here again, from what we know so far, that evidence has not been made available to the public anyway. And it is imperative for the United States to show that its assassination was in fact meeting that criteria in order for it to be justified under the rules on use of force. It's interesting to note that in Iran's response to the assassination, they did use the language of Article 51 of the UN Charter and say that they were acting in response with the two strikes in a proportionate way in self-defense. But it's also interesting to note that both the United States and Iran here initially made justifications having to do with revenge and reprise for past acts rather than with respect to responding to imminent threats.
Hamid Sami, mm-hmm. One of the key questions here then is if the U.S. was acting in some degree of self-defense or some degree of retaliation, General Soleimani certainly had a record of supporting armed groups that the U.S. has labeled as terrorist groups. So, first of all, how accurate was it that the U.S. had described him as a terrorist? And is this any different than, say, the U.S. that the targeted assassination of someone like, say, al-Baghdadi or Osama bin Laden?
I might address the issue from a different perspective in looking at the legality of it and then how the United States used that to use its reason for doing what it did. If we look at this from the principle of sovereignty, so we have a sovereign state that is Iraq, and then we have the United States, which has interest in Iraq, is intervening or launching an attack against a person, a leader, whoever he is, representing another sovereign state who was there in Iraq by invitation of a sovereign state that Iraq. Bring all that together, and now let's look at the legality of this in the international law. it's certainly from that perspective, what we've seen is a violation of the rights of a sovereign state. The sovereign state, that is, the intervention in Iraq, despite that the United States has a legal obligation, has an agreement with Iraq. To what extent the agreement that the United States has with Iraq goes to take actions against another sovereign, a representative of a sovereign state, okay, that is Iran, does that agreement allow it to us? So that's one aspect of it. As scholars, I think from the scholarly academic perspective, it's really a puzzle. So if we look at that, the puzzle from the legality of it, certainly there is a case you could make looking from the sovereign perspective of a state that this action is indeed a violation of a sovereign state's rights to exist as an independent. Now, from the other perspective of identifying Soleimani as a terrorist agent and therefore gives the United States a right to go after him and assassinate him in a different setting, in a different country, and under the pretext that there was an imminent threat that we yet to see. That to me is entering us into a dangerous territory where political interests are used and misused to constitute a legal foundation for an act. This is as if to say that in March 2003, when the United States invaded Iraq with a number of other countries, that it has a United Nations Security Council backing. This is also to say that the United States used, they had evidence to use that to launch that attacks against Iraq, because it allegedly Iraq had, or at the time it wasn't allegedly, because Iran has evidence that Iraq possessed weapons of mass destruction. Those are very, very serious questions. So from my perspective, the action that the United States took against Soleimani have to be put in a context beyond what with the act itself. Number one, why is Soleimani in Iraq? Are there a reason when we say he caused the life of many Americans and hundreds of thousands that? Who are we, the people we're talking about? And is the United States presence and the foreign presence in Iraq, aren't they a root cause also of that problem? So you enter the territory where you say, my terrorist is your freedom fighter. That's the argument that we are, and that's where Soleimani, for example, is praised as someone very well respected in Iran and Middle Eastern countries, and not in the West. That's why the issue of constitutionality and legality, it boils down to how we approach that perspective of international law, and certainly looking at it from a revolutionary perspective or from a sovereignty state perspective. It's a different territory from launching on the pretext that we right ahead we say that this is a terrorist, and as a result we have to act against it. Now, there are interventions in international law under the right to protect, the R2P, but that again you have to prove that there are violations that requires the intervention, that the crimes committed in that area requires the intervention of an international, of the international community, meaning that the crimes that Soleimani initiated on behalf of Iran requires that the United States act on behalf of the world community to go after them. So it's a very, very complicated issue from that academic side. Bringing the politics of it is another argument.
You're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. We're discussing the legal and political ramifications of the U.S. use of force in the drone strike against General Soleimani. Now, Mark Drumble, as Professor Salleh just raised, the legality as well as the politics of the strike is rooted, at least in part, in the U.S. decision to invade Iraq in 2003. You cited this question of imminence and anticipatory self-defense, and the fact that that information has not been forthcoming at this point from the U.S. administration. But the administration at that time, President Bush, made an argument that seemed to relax some of the requirements of imminence in what he would call the doctrine of prevention. How valid is imminence as the guidepost for military action in light of the fact that, you know, again, the U.S. had raised the issue that even if the strike wasn't imminent, it was eventually coming. And so, therefore, the U.S. was justified in attacking and removing an administration in Saddam Hussein's government that was intending at some point in the future, once it had capacity, to attack the United States.
Right. So, I mean, I think that's a very interesting segue to kinds of conversations that lawyers like to have, and those are definitional conversations. So imminence has always been recognized as a valid justification to use force in self-defense. As Hannah pointed out, if it's overwhelming, if it's just right in your face, if it's about to happen, if it's almost inexorable or inevitable, then the use of force in response can be understood. And as you correctly pointed out, in the early 2000s, the Bush administration circulated a national security policy that advocated for the idea of preemptive self-defense or a precautionary, that it is in our interests of our own self-defense to prevent anyone from ever becoming a threat. And there was quite a vivid conversation at that time about whether self-defense was sufficiently elastic so as to absorb this idea of preemptive self-defense. And I have to say, if you're going to measure the legitimacy of law by the amount of discourse that a particular legal definition attracts, I have to say that in the wake of the Bush administration, the idea of preemptive self-defense has acquired less and less traction. I think this was an idea that may have hit its sort of discursive peak in the Bush administration and since then has waned much more than it's waxed. So I think we're returning a little bit more to a slightly more traditional understanding of imminence. But I think there's actually a reason for that. And I think one of the reasons for that is through technology and drone warfare and automated killings, the technology shifts the kinds of conversations that we need to be having around the very idea of when violence is justified. I mean, going back to the 2003 Iraq intervention, the Bush administration went to great lengths to try and justify what it was doing, with Colin Powell going to the United Nations Security Council, making an argument, unsuccessful, I think, but making an argument that the use of force had been authorized by bootstrapping onto prior resolutions. Then the Bush administration made a public argument in favor of self-defense. The Bush administration also made an argument rooted in humanitarian armed intervention, namely, Saddam was killing his own people, and is it not legitimate or moral to use violence to get rid of someone who's tormenting his own population when his own population has no redress? But in all of those instances, there was some need to go out into a public space and justify what one was doing and present evidence. Whether the evidence was complete or erroneous is a secondary question to there was a need for some form of public justification, public conversation, public expression. And the thing that concerns me the most is how now, with the advent of targeted technology that can engage in these levels of assassination, what I see increasingly shrinking in public space is the need for these conversations, because there's no more any need to bolster public support for something or to get people to fight on your side, or to justify allocations of resources from Congress, for example. There's less of a need to make a public case to use violence in international relations because we don't need the public anymore to the same extent, because we can just have technology and push a button and that entire decision-making process can be closeted and cloistered in the office of the president, and that's it. And to me, that is the broader challenge. How do we develop a regulatory frame for targeted killings when the technology no longer requires the deployer of the drone to make any public case for what he or she is doing. And that is what I see happening with regards to this latest instance. But this is the same issue that arose in the Obama administration. Mm-hmm. President Obama deployed plenty of similar targeted killings. Mm-hmm. And I think these debates around the legality of this are forever going to be relics of the past, or just people speaking to each other but never hearing each other, so long as we still rely on an antiquated vocabulary of imminence, of self-defense, of national borders. And we're going to see a similar clouding of traditional legal discourse also with things like cyber attacks. Like, you can just sit at home and basically, if you have the technology, shut down the entire internet grid, healthcare system, a communication system of another state. Mm-hmm. And I'm a lawyer, and I really like law, and I really like international law, and I really believe in it. But to me, the application of traditional legal discourse to current technology is like trying to shove a square peg into a round hole, or vice versa. And I think we can have all these conversations like the one that we're having here, which is a wonderfully important conversation about, is this legal or not? And the answer is, who cares? Because these conversations are not going to stop the deployment of drone warfare in this sense, because the conversation is not a precondition to developing public support, because you don't need any public support. And herein lies another grave problem, in my opinion. The deployment of this drone technology is deeply asymmetrical and deeply uneven, because the technological capacity only lies in the hands of relatively small number of states. So I think that's what I see as the broader challenge. And it's not a challenge of law's legitimacy. It's a challenge of law emerging in response to technological change that renders so much of traditional conflict and the ways of waging it obsolete.
Now, Hannah Gary, you had raised several legal instruments that Professor Drumble would have highlighted as part of what perhaps is becoming an antiquated, or perhaps has already become an antiquated area of law in this sort of modern warfare but classical legal structure. First, do you agree with his distinction? And if so, how would you address some of his concerns?
I agree with Mark in the sense that technology and use of drones in modern warfare is certainly asymmetrical, although we do see increasingly this technology getting into the hands of less powerful states and also non-state actors, which is concerning. And I also agree that this technology allows for states or non-state actors to act in purported self-defense, or to act aggressively, for that matter, without needing to get any support or backing from relevant stakeholders. And here Mark refers to the public, I assume in a democratic situation like our own here in the United States. But I would like to push back a bit with regard to the notion that the rules put into place following World War II under the UN Charter are classical, and that are a bit anachronistic to address these situations, and would contend that the fact that technology makes it so easy for a state to respond with the push of a button, and then in the aftermath to make claims of imminence that may or may not be true, all the more this technology emphasizes the need for states to hold each other accountable, as they are supposed to under the UN Charter, to provide justification for use of force and to present evidence to the United Nations Security Council in the face of threats to international peace and security or to imminent threats to their self-defense even before there's an armed attack, that would justify the use of such technology, which can be used so quickly. And so while the public may not need to support any longer because it's so easy to use this technology to respond, other states need to be persuaded. And there does need, I would contend that the requirement under the UN there to be a dialogue at the United Nations level amongst other states and a meeting of the minds looking at the evidence before a state acts so quickly with the use of technology that allows it to act even quicker is imperative. And there needs to be that conversation beforehand, unless, of course, it is that situation of the anticipatory self-defense doctrine or there's an actual armed attack against a state where it does, and it's clear, the evidence is clear to all, to states and to the public alike. But apart from those two situations, the conversation needs to be had regardless of how sophisticated the technology becomes. I think the rules that have been put in place are still wise and applicable and are necessary. They're there for maintaining rule of law and trying to maintain international peace and security. And we see how in this situation with the assassination of Soleimani, how quickly things could have spiraled out of control and with the back and forth between these two countries. And it's really up to other states through the United Nations to enforce these rules under the UN Charter on Use of Force. And there should be an objective inquiry into what happened in this situation such that these kinds of targeted assassinations by one state against another do not become a norm.
When we come back, we explore the legality and the implications of the current U.S. military actions against Iran. Stay with us. Listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armodian. What determines the legality of military strikes and the choice of targets? In today's program, we examine the importance of international law and, in particular, its role in the increased tensions between the United States and Iran. Our contributing host, Doug Becker, raises these questions with three experts: Mark Drumble of Washington and Lee Law School, Hannah Gary of the University of Southern California Law School, and Hamoud Salhi of California State University, Dominguez Hills.
The other key question that Professor Drumble raised, Hamoud Salhi, is that sort of what does this matter if there's less engagement in the public? And I know that there's been a great deal of conversation about that here in the United States. But also, how important are the legal questions or the questions about, you know, the justification of these actions, such as the targeted assassination in the Arab world and in the region? How much is support or opposition to U.S. policy driven by the perception of the legality of the actions versus something that might be a bit more, you know, based on what international relations scholars might just call, you know, your national interest, what material interests or some opportunity that the, you know, the decision might have arisen that might give your country an opportunity to take advantage of that?
So I think there are two points there. Number one is addressing the issue of whether technology has made the public more engaged or less engaged. Technology doesn't operate in a vacuum. There is a social context, a political context, an economic context, and all of that. It operates in a setting, a theater that is determined. It has some kind of cause and effect relation. So the use of technology in the end is constrained by certain means, certain context. So a use of technology by the United States is different from the use of technology by a country like Iran or Algeria, or for that matter. The type of technological advancement the United States has is certainly different or far advanced than other places. So technology must be looked at in a context. With that said, the second question to that is whether technology matters, whether this action, this started killing matters. It's a very, very important question, but I see it from the other side. And the public, in fact, matters the most. We're ignoring one important factor here, I think, the social media, the engagement of the public, the fear that now any action you do might end up on YouTube or on a Twitter or something else, another kind of tool. I think the public today matters more than before. Now, what is changing is that just as we become sophisticated in our usage of the social media tools, the elite, if you want, or those who have power also become very sophisticated in directing the social media in ways that benefit them or serve their interest. So in the end, the tool that we use in this technology is being used to reflect the opinion of one group or another. This is not different from giving a speech in the past to a group of supporters or leaflet or, you know, the cassette that we had or the tapes that we had in the past. So it's very important to look at the issue whether the social media acts like this are no longer controlled by the public because the public doesn't matter. It matters a lot just for that fact. Now, if we bring that to the context of legality, your other question, in the Arab world and how it's perceived, I'll just give you an example. If we bring the Palestinian issue to the Arab world today, with all the legality, the violation of or the alleged sort of attack on Israel and on all of that politics that comes with the Palestinian issue, the legality of the international issue, the international law supporting the Palestinian causes is what the Arab world is using. International law matters in the Arab world. Maybe it does so for the weak, and that's another argument that one could look at it, because international law is in the end defined and implemented by, it seems from this perspective, the stronger, and it has been that way for a long time. So targeting, putting it in a context of legality, is something that the Arab world will look favorably, and they want to see the international law implemented. This is perhaps why the Iranian wanted the United Nations Security Council. This is why you constantly hear a reference in the Arab world of a violation of human rights and so on and so forth. So from my perspective, two points. One, to summarize a bit, technology really matters, and the public today matters more than anything else. The usage of a drone, this idea, you know, it's boundless, and how can you control it? Certainly, we need to do more in international law. We need to have that debate and find a way of how to integrate it. When you have a force behind an action and using the international institution to come up with means to address that issue, when you have a big power like the United States, you could see it. The debate before 9/11 in the circle of international of terrorism is centered around the conception of international terrorism. What does it mean? Who are the actors included in this international law? And the United States was seen as someone who was a hindrance to the adoption of international resolution in the Security Council. Well, following 9/11, we had in a span of 3 months, 18 United Nations Security Council resolution passed, all spelling out how states are becoming responsible for so-called terrorist or alleged terrorist activities in their own countries. In other words, what we're saying is that after 9/11, because a force like the United States were able to come up with the definition of what is seen as terrorism, something that we were not able to do before. The same thing with targeting or the pursuit, all of that. So just as technology doesn't operate in the vacuum, and so is international law. There are powers that seems to have more say than others, and certainly smaller states tend to have less impact than that. So definition of targeting also must be looked at in that perspective, and so is technology.
Mark Trumbull, to highlight that question, that's always been one of the great ironies of international law, hasn't it, that in essence the law has typically been set by the powerful states, and when there's changes in practices and what's considered legal, the more powerful the state is, the more likely they are to actually change a definition or an interpretation of the law. But arguments on international law are typically cited by weaker states as a way to kind of tie down more powerful states from just doing whatever they want. So ultimately, with that in mind, is it that international law has become less relevant because of the nature of technology and, you know, some of the issues you raised about, you know, for instance, drone technology being possessed by the most powerful military actors? Or is the law simply changing because of American practice, and we're going to see an evolution of the use of force altered because of the technological advances, but still binding in some way on the states who are using that force?
Well, it's a great question. As I see it, international law generally only matters to the extent that the powerful care about it. And it is true that weaker states deploy legal arguments in order to assert claims, but that's no different than in any society where generally law is invoked and cited by weaker groups or groups that are not treated particularly fairly, because if you're at the top, you don't really need to rely on law in the same way. And to me, I think this opens up an interesting conversational space about what to do about it, because one thing we are seeing with Trump is the following. The drone attack has to be placed in a broader context in which President Trump clearly indicates through his own use of social media a very take it or leave it, laissez-faire attitude about law. So he had tweeted out that he would be perfectly happy to deploy reprisal measures that were not proportionate. That's a clear violation of international law. He had tweeted out that he was game to destroy Iranian cultural property. That's another clear violation of international law. In both of those instances, the Defense Department sort of ratcheted that down, certainly on the cultural property destruction tweet that he had sent out, and said, no, we're not actually going to deliberately target, you know, ancient monuments, that many of which are in Iran. So to me, the interesting question is the following. If international law really only matters to the extent that the powerful care about it and moderate their own behavior in recognition of it, to me, that suggests that the ultimate check and balance on the disregard by the executive branch of the government of international law, the check and balance to that must come from other segments of powerful societies and other branches of government, public life, or institutions within powerful societies. And I would suggest that instead of just generically lamenting a disregard of law that is permissible increasingly through technology and the fact that a lot of the quote-unquote law is amorphous, vague, difficult to enforce, and slightly obsolete, to me, the major call to rectify and remedy lies in a much more vigorous legislative response, a greater emphasis on the various branches of government, recourse to the judiciary, within the polity of the powerful. And I think that's an important argument to make and an important path forward. There's another thing I think I'd also like to reference that I think is salient, and we haven't really spoken about all that much, although you just alluded to it. What induces changes in the law of war? And to me, there's a very interesting argument to be made that if you look at the history of the laws of war, it is actually marked by more powerful states that have better technology that then push law that renders the older technology illegal or bans it. A very good example is chemical weapons. Chemical weapons were very liberally used, as we all know, in World War I, and they were horrific and horrible. And then chemical weapons began to become limited and regulated internationally, in large part because powerful states didn't need them anymore, because they had better technology that was not necessarily as problematic as chemical weapons. And you could really take a Marxist analysis in general to the laws of war and say that progress that is made involves banning certain weaponry or certain tactics, like carpet bombing entire cities. But if you've got the technology, you don't need to do that anymore. So it's easy to ban it. And of course, that satisfies a human rights agenda as well, because you don't want innocent civilians getting killed. And I think one of the, to me, a very interesting intersection between technology, drones, autonomous weapon systems, automated weapon systems, cyber weapon systems, is that I think what we might see in a generation is a coupling of very powerful states together with human rights activists that will begin to make arguments that putting a human being in conflict, putting a human being in a conflict zone, having soldiers, flesh and blood, men and women, fight in war for your side, I think arguments are increasingly going to be made that that is barbaric and a human rights violation. And the argument will be made by states that can outfit and run entire drone armies, clone armies, and autonomous weapon systems. So I think this is also, to me, the use of this drone technology is not an aberration, but is a permanent shift in violence. It permits powerful states to commit violence without putting any of their own soldiers in harm's way, while inflicting, hopefully targeted, but you can never control that, harms on weaker states. So to ratchet all this together, I think the way forward is to develop and continue to foster a consciousness among the powerful that it matters to us how we decide to deploy our incredible capacity to engage in military interventions. And to me, that's the slippage that I find the most disconcerting about contemporary discourse. I do not believe, and the co-panelists can please try to make me feel better about this by pointing out to me that there have been worse times in recent generations. But I can't remember when we have had an executive branch so strongly supported still in the legislature that has been so punctually dismissive of international law. Even the Bush administration tried to make their arguments for what they were doing within a legalistic framework, instead of just saying, like, who cares, and saying, oh, I'm going to respond in ways that are manifestly illegal and just tweet that out or just say that. Now, so that's where I see as the root here.
You're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. We're discussing the legal and political ramifications of the U.S. use of force in the drone strike against General Soleimani, with Mark Drumble of Washington and Lee University School of Law, Hannah Gary of the University of Southern California School of Law, and Hamoud Salih of California State University at Dominguez Hills. Now, Hannah Gary, in your comments, you certainly want to continue to assert the role the United Nations plays, the UN Charter plays in these questions. So first, does the UN still have that role to play? And, you know, considering that, again, it reflects the interest of the most powerful states on the Security Council, but still a way to try to constrain those states. And then also Professor Drumble's, you know, question about this administration. Are we in a unique time because the nature of the U.S. administration is so disregarding of international law, or is this a trend and we're moving in this direction?
I do think that the U.N. still has a role to play, even in light of the powerful influence that the most powerful states do have on the development and enforcement of international law. We see in these times where some of the most powerful states sitting on the UN Security Council, the United States, Russia, China, that were at the end of World War II given the mandate to have primary responsibility for maintenance of international peace and security, are at this very moment some of the biggest, most problematic causes of instability around the globe. And so Mark's point there is well taken. Nevertheless, you see that other states that are less powerful are forming powerful coalitions in the United Nations framework and are pushing back and have really taken the norms and the rules that have been developed over the last several decades and have imbibed this consciousness. And yes, obviously, a lot of these rules are being raised, and they're seeking enforcement for their own protection and self-interest as less powerful states. Nevertheless, I think it goes beyond that. I think that there has been an absorption, a real belief in the importance of these rules and in developing new, better rules and better enforcement mechanisms to make sure that we have a rule of law system globally between states. With regard to the comments on our current administration and the way in which the United States in particular seems to be completely flouting the norms, not even having a sort of not even pretending to have a consciousness around the importance of them or of upholding them as one of the most powerful countries in the world. Yes, but I wouldn't take the tweets coming out of the White House as representative of the rest of our government. Obviously, the Department of Defense and our military have been retracting from a number of these statements that are clearly in violation of the laws of war. There has been pushback even within the Republican Party against these comments and these statements. There has, while they may be in lockstep for political reasons, I do not think that here in the United States that within our legislative and judicial branches and then within the public that we are in danger of a complete throwing off of understanding of the importance of these rules and upholding them for global stability and order. It's just that at the moment, our president has a very loud megaphone, but his tweets do not represent, in my view, the majority of Americans and our perspective and our consciousness around these rules and our desire to uphold them.
Hamoud Salih, how do you see these actions playing out in the region, considering the issues that have been raised, the legal issues, the political issues? How damaged is the U.S. in the eyes of Arab nations, you know, with this action? And is this something that ultimately rests with the current administration, so a change in the administration, whether that takes place later this year or in 4 years, would reverse this? Or is this something, are these issues that are probably likely to linger for quite some time?
I agree with the last portion when you said they're most likely to linger for a long time. What's very interesting about this Trumpian variable in global politics and in the Arab world is the fact that when President Donald Trump was elected, he was actually liked in the Arab world, and he was seen as someone who is actually going to shift away from politics or political difficult questions to economics, a transactional leader who would, despite all the Twitters, all the negative sides he was saying, continues to say he had a positive view or a perception in the Arab world for the fact that he was coming from a background that was different from what they have been accustomed to. And the Arab world has also seen a period of sort of a sense of disappointment from President Barack Obama's term. The Arab world had high hopes for President Barack Obama, particularly when he gave that wonderful speech about revising American perception in the Middle East and togetherness, and he would be fair to the Arab world. In other words, the perception, that the positive perception that President Barack Obama created, and which he's never lived up to, was sort of contrary to what people saw in President Donald Trump. They saw him as a person who was like how the conservative or neoconservatives see him, someone who is, you know, naive, not from the political establishment, but that would be good. Enough politics, this man, sort of maybe we could trust him in ways that we did not trust President Barack Obama. But recent development, particularly when it comes to the Arab-Israeli issue, the Palestinian-Israeli issue, the Jerusalem issue, the refugees that may come up here, this grand design about the resolution of the century or the deal of the century, all these grandiose ideas that have never seen them implemented, and the unilateral and conditional support for Israel, all made him appear, people did not look at him as favorably as they were. But despite all of that, and because the Palestinian issue has lost steam, that it was no longer on the center of the political stage, and because the United States and the conflicts in Iraq and Yemen was more or less involved with one side or another, the perception about Donald Trump sort of did not suffer as much as it is suffering in the United States today, even though it remains sort of divided along party lines. But the perceptions remain somewhat not as bad as one would think, regardless of what it means. But a recent development, what's happening with the killing of Soleimani, what's happening with how President Donald Trump has used his Twitter, and all of that are having more impact, more and more impact on the United States foreign policy. For the Iraqi parliament, despite however we want to describe it, coming out and say all foreign forces must leave Iraq, for Muqtada Sadr, who was, you know, for a while out of the political line, to come out now and mobilize his forces all against foreign forces and with the pretext, you know, you have to read United States forces, for this to be revived, and you know, the way the Iranian responded altogether, this is a strong signal that the region is becoming very disturbed. And it touches, in fact, the public directly. Those of us who have relatives in Dubai or in Qatar or in Khalid or any country in the Gulf region, if you ask them about this last few days, about how they are feeling, most likely the response would be they were terrified. I have a friend of mine who is in Dubai. She could not. Her response is what, Hamoud, we're really terrified here. We don't know what's happened. And her word is exactly word is that this madman, and she meant both parties or whatever she had in mind, but specifically, she is concerned. The same thing in the Gulf region. These are regions that were very supportive of the United States. Most of the elites in the Gulf countries are product of our own educational system here. They graduated from here. They loved us. They loved our gene as you used to. Not now, not after what was happening lately. And this is a cause for disturbance. So if you bring back the idea of legality, all of that, it does matter for the Arab world that the international law is respected, because they see it as the last resort, that perhaps put them equal to the big powers, in case either the United States or another country.
So with that, I think of the role that international law has traditionally played in international relations is to try to create some degree of stability and some degree of predictiveness with certain expectations that, you know, there's simply policies that states try to avoid or typically will avoid because the perception is that they are illegal. And it's striking to me that the administration took a position that had been rejected by previous administrations largely because of both the concern of international actors and the instability that such an action would create within the region. It was disregarded by this administration, and what seems to be, you know, produced as a result of that is in fact instability. So I suppose one of the main lessons we can take from today's conversation and from following the events in the region is that one of the greatest accomplishments, one of the greatest importances of international law isn't necessarily the prosecution of those who violate it, but with an expectation of stability and an expectation of a certain predictiveness so we can understand how states are going to act. So perhaps the lesson we take from this is when you break the law, very similar to Colin Powell's famous Pottery Barn statement about Iraq, if you break it, you own it. Thank you very much to the panel for today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's a good ending.
Thank you.
Thanks. Mark Drumble is professor at Washington and Lee University School of Law and director of the Transnational Law Institute. He has written Reimagining Child Soldiers in International Law and Policy. Hannah Gary is clinical professor of law at the University of Southern California. She is director of the International Human Rights Clinic. She has written Witness Proofing in the International Criminal Law Procedure, the Interface of Civil Law and Common Law Legal Systems. And Hamoud Salih is associate dean of International Education at California State University at Dominguez Hills. He is a specialist in Middle East politics and commentator for Arab media.
And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, contributing host Doug Becker, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page. Most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.